So, may I introduce you to Ted Mann, screenwriter or TV writer, actor, producer.
Bitte?
Ins Mikro sprechen, okay.
Ted, as you may, or as you know, we would like to hear a little bit from you on the profession of the scriptwriter for TV shows and on the kind of cooperation you had with somebody like David Milch, who you worked with on several shows. Maybe to start the conversation, could you tell us a bit how you came to script writing at all, and how you came in touch with somebody like David Milch?
I was a magazine editor in New York City. That was not my first job, but it was certainly my first real job. And before that, I had left home when I was young, and I worked in mines and logging camps and places like that in Canada, and reached the conclusion that that was hard work, and that I would take the easier, softer path. I used to send work to magazines, and they buy it, and that's how I wound up there. But even in, I think, about the end of the 1970s, it seemed to me that that was not the profession of the future, and I started. I wrote a film, and did that for a while, but. And a couple of, you know, a few were made, but it's dealer's choice there. The director is still all, certainly it was then. And when your first director is Robert Altman, you can get a real disaster. You can get a complete dog's breakfast, they call it. And I did, so I wanted to see some of my work in film, and thought I'd try television, and ended up, I can't remember exactly how I met David, but I remember we went to the track, and he has a life story, which I won't tell you because it has, you know, some grisly and intimate details, but it's not that, he doesn't tell them to everyone almost that he meets if there's time. It's just that I wouldn't feel right about second-handing that information. So we went to the racetrack and I've been friends ever since. And I worked with him on NYPD Blue and then on numerous other things that didn't grow, and then again on Deadwood. But for those of you who were here yesterday, Tom Fontana described him quite well. Rather unforgettable personality.
Did you ever go to some kind of writing school or course or?
I never did. When I was in the only school I went to was a boys' boarding school in Canada, and I was unfortunately, I wasn't expelled, but I was. They thought it was better if I did not come back. So that was a pretty early date. But I mentioned, you know, I left home. I educated myself in the public library system, which is fortunately pretty good there. And I knew I'd be a writer because, sometimes you do, you know, it's like any other vocation. And I sent manuscripts to I thought I'd write books, you know, I didn't realize that was hard work too. I sent manuscripts to a writer who was very well known at the time and probably not so much now, a guy named Lawrence Durrell. And he had written, he's written a lot of stuff. But anyway, he was very kind. I was like 14 years old or something, so He'd send but nice notes, a little bit of criticism, keep working, that sort of thing. And yeah, that was my education, that and the film school. And then when I went to the magazine, every single person there was from Harvard University, except me. So that was my, you know, my kind of finishing school. And I learned about, you know, social behaviors and, well, to the extent I've learned at all about social behaviors, I learned them there. And a few other details that I missed. You know, I mean, people who educate themselves tend to be, you know, strong in one area and kind of weak in others. Well, that's certainly true in my experience, you know.
So was it to you from the start when you started writing for TV shows, was it that you had the feeling that there was some freedom to do specific things? So you didn't expect to work for a traditional kind of television, is that?
Yes, that's true. And that freedom comes if you're sitting next to an 800-pound gorilla, which is an expression they use for a producer who is, you know, sufficiently well-regarded as to be able to have his own way in the industry. That would include Tom Fontana, David Milch, David Chase, and there were a few, Stephen Bochco, a few others, so that you would not have to have contact with persons who were not artists. You wouldn't deal with the executives whose concerns were first, their own jobs, and second, the profitability of their networks. And that's the wrong order, of course, and that's why the networks aren't doing as well as they might otherwise be doing, because you know, they will sacrifice the interests of the network if it'll keep their jobs. So anyway, you know, I always work with Stephen Bochco or David or someone like that, so that you know, if they tolerate me, I would be allowed to do what I wanted. And, you know, that was a great way to learn, for instance, that you shouldn't bring in a guest star to a series and put all the regulars aside. Because, it's very jarring for difficult. The public. Yeah.
How can we imagine you know, a communication process going on that starts from, I don't know, some kind of idea a creator has and ends in, let's say, the first season of a show. Mm-hmm. And maybe if you like at the example of Deadwood.
Sure, sure. Well, as I recall, David didn't want to do a Western. David wanted to do a show about police in Rome. And their first arrest was going to be St. Paul. And he went to HBO, and they liked that idea, and they were going to do that. And Chris Albrecht, who was running it at the time, you know, gave his blessing. And then David had done some ghostwriting for, I think it was the Scott brothers who made that Gladiator movie. And they called everyone and said, well, if you do that, we will sue you. So I don't know whether it was David or Chris, but somebody said, well, why don't you do a Western? Because nobody's done one. It's a dead art form, and you could bring some life to it, I'm sure. And that's, you know, that's when David began to work on Deadwood. Now, I wasn't there until the 12th episode. I mean, I was around, but I was working on something else. And when the only thing I knew about the 12th episode was that it was going to be General Crook was going to come to town. And General Crook was a U.S. military officer in the cavalry who had been assigned to seek revenge or to punish the Indians for the Battle of the Little Bighorn, where General Custer was massacred with his entire troop. And Crook was a man of conscience, and he was a good officer. And, you know, so beginning with that bit of information, and he they did what they weren't able to find. The Indian group was composed of many members of different bands who had scattered, and they weren't able to find them. And Crooks and his men, I think they call it the March of Mud and Blood, and they ended up eating their horses, which for a cavalry officer is not a good thing. You know, it's very disheartening. And nevertheless, on the way back, they managed to do the gesture, which could be construed, if you had a strong stomach, as adequate justice being done. They burned a couple of half-empty villages and put the residents, who were old men and women, to death. And then they made it to Deadwood. Now, that I knew that that after you do something like that, you don't feel triumphant, and you probably just as soon send a letter to the boss and say, you know, we got it done, and let's not talk about it anymore. However, the civilian population, unaware of these details, are ready to celebrate. And so you would have this disheartened group of people led by an honorable man come in starving and ill themselves from this march to a town that was ready to celebrate, you know, and to honor them. And that would require a speech from the general. And that would be a speech that would walk a very specific line, you know, that would tell the truth and would say, without dishonoring the need of the audience to feel that they had somehow, there had been some retribution, would tell the truth. And fortunately, I had 12 episodes to work on that speech. So, I mean, the time it took to shoot the other 11 episodes. So that was the only thing I knew about it. And the rest of the train was just rolling along. And it rolled pretty well, I thought, that year. And there was, I wanted to say something about, because somebody will ask this later anyway, there was a controversy about the amount of profanity in there. And it was usually, you know, I mean, Fontana mentioned yesterday that David kind of defended it using Dante. David has a great command of, he was a professor at Yale, a great command of the classical world, and he wrote an essay and mounted that kind of defense, because that's who the people who were raising objections to the language were. And one woman actually said to me, you know, did they say cocksucker back then? And I said, well, I think so, yeah. He said, well, I thought that's something we came up with. And I said, what do you mean? He said, in the hippie era, I thought we invented that. No, that's not the case. It's just wrong. And but the real defense is this, you know, I worked in mines and logging camps, and that's how people talked. And when you listen to it long enough, it's filtered out. You don't hear it anymore. And before the pilot went out, we're still editing it. I said to David, you know, this will affect foreign sales, because it's not going to get any, they'll never be able to show it on the air. There's too much profanity. He said, well, why don't you go in and sit with the editor and see how many cocksuckers you can take out? I said, all right. And I went in and I did, and I listened, you know, sat there with Beth and and, you know, because my background is literature too, I always count the feet in the meter, you know, of people's speech, and I notice if it's off balance and so does he. He sits there and you can see us going like that, and I couldn't find one that I could take out that wouldn't imbalance something. So as mercenary as I am, I wasn't able to do that. It was all of a piece, and it stayed that way. And And I think my mother has been pretending to have watched it for that reason ever since.
You know, Ted, what people like I have a hard time imagining how it works is that you have such a very sophisticated show, you know, in many aspects. For instance, yeah, the use of languages, yeah. Or, you know, the complexity of personnel, you know, the certain humor, yeah. We were just able to watch in the first episode here, you know, this kind of very strange kind of, you know, oh, sorry. This strange kind of humor that comes along with, you know, this kind of brutality and the profanity and all that, you know. And this goes through the entire series, pretty homogeneous.
Yeah.
And we wonder how does that work, knowing that apart from David Milch and apart from you, there were about, I don't know, 15, 20 writers on the show, you know. How is it being communicated? How do you work day by day?
You know, human beings are great imitators. And that's what we do with our theater. It's imitation, and originally of subject matter that was too emotionally difficult to look at directly, so that you would put the imitation on. The Greeks would put the imitation on the stage. You don't want to see, you know, a son kill his mother. You can look at it in the mirror, and that's a way to talk about it. And that facility for imitation is all that a writer has to begin the craft with. And you know, some were more successful than others, but it stays the same because David, or the showrunner, whoever the showrunner is on any show, is ultimately, responsible for the final product. And so it may be that there are some writers who would get only their punctuation in because the rest of it, you know, was not adequate. And it's no reflection on the craft or gift of a writer to wind up with only a semicolon on one of David's shows or anybody else's show. It's a difficult thing sometimes to grasp the essence of or the core of what's going on, and it's much easier to grasp the surface. And I know there was a professor at Tucson who's a friend of mine who teaches English there, and he's a very distinguished guy. And I love the show, and he came out and he said, you know, I've written a script. Will you take a look at it? I said, of course. And it had the surface appearance, you know. I mean, it was just like straight. He was deceived by the profanity, by the glitter of the jewels, if you will, you know. And so the script was all jewels, and I was just complimentary, you know. But it's that happens, you know, it happens. You have to start from the inside of a character, the inside place of a script, and David, because of his life history, and I think. Being a professor and also having buried people in Mexico is qualified, and also being deeply imaginative and living his life on that level as well, was uniquely kind of qualified for this particular work. And that's it.
So. You know, for instance, something I would imagine, and I've heard that this is, you know, this is a way of working these kind of things, is that writers get handed out like profiles, you know, characterizations of the main characters, with, you know, certain essentials in there that always have to be considered when writing.
That'd be a good idea if you could ever persuade David to engage in any kind of formal process. But he feels that those constitute a trap for the imagination, and he won't engage with them at all. So it's very difficult. Someone will come in, and what Dave likes to do is to lie on the floor, and everything he says is tape recorded. He lies on the floor in the middle of a room and comes in the morning, and he talks for 2 hours about the character, the show, what this character might do. And everything he'll say will be as if it's going to happen, that this is what the character is. Now, if you make the mistake, and you're right. All his writers, with the exception of one, are sitting there, and the interns, because David hires many interns. If you're ever in Los Angeles, go look David up and say you'd like to be an intern, because he also pays them. And there were 31 of them, I think, on Deadwood was the top limit. They come from every walk of life. They're old, they're young. And they're required to sit for 2 hours every morning and listen to David talk about the characters. Now, I think that, I know that what David is doing when he talks to 31 people is he is able to look at each person and build them into a character, build them, you know, draws on that as a resource. So he'll talk for 2 hours like that about the characters and then I read the notes and I think, well, where in the story might I, you know, where is this story going to go based on what this is? And I'll guess what a scene is up ahead and I'll write it and I'll turn it in. And that's what you gotta do. And some people are more successful at that than others. It's a daunting adventure. After he does that, then he'll go away and do other things and come back and write in the afternoon. Now, you see, we don't have scripts in advance on that show because David doesn't like that. He's the only person who shoots that way, and that's the 900-pound gorilla thing again. Nobody likes that because they don't get to see the scripts in advance. They don't know what they're going to get. Mistakes can be made and have been. But when somebody has made over $1 billion for the industry, they go, you know what? Well, let's take a shot, you know? Sure, the guy's crazy, you know? Who wouldn't want to have an architectural drawing before you started building a skyscraper? Well, you know, David. So, you know, we write the stuff that'll shoot the next day. If we're lucky, we'll have enough for 2 days, you know? And that means if, you know, there's a lot of fingers crossed that, you know, nobody gets sick. And it's very exciting, and the actors find it exciting and infuriating, and it produces great results sometimes. At the end of the movie Little Big Man, which if you haven't seen, I'd recommend it, the Indian chief, played by Dan George, is lying down and is going to sing his death song. He's sung it, he lies down to die. His son, Little Big Man, is waiting, and a raindrop is falling on his head. And after a moment, he wakes up and he says, "Sometimes the magic works, and sometimes it doesn't."
I don't know if I told you that I spoke to Liz Zarnoff on the phone also, you know, preparation of this, and she told me that very often that there was no real script when shooting started. There were fragments to a script, mm-hmm. right? But then she says she and other writers were present, and Milch, of course, and the actors were already kind of in position, and then still certain things were developed. Can you confirm this?
Oh, certainly, yeah. When David would always be there for a rehearsal, one, because, you know, he likes to supervise, make sure the blocking is to his order. That's, you know, the placement of the actors and their movements during the scene. And also because he'll do a little rewrite there. I mean, if something is missing, he'll add it. And if something is obtruding, he will remove it. And, you know, anybody else is free to make suggestions too. The cinematographer or the guy who's sweeping the floor, for that matter. You want to be careful you don't make an unnecessary one, that's all. But that, I mean, the process continues, you know, his resistance to paperwork and bureaucracy is thoroughgoing. It goes all the way through. And if you like that security, you're going to find it unbearable, you know, as an artist or as, you know, whatever your function is. And if you like the freedom or the spontaneity, despite its hazards, then it's a delightful way to go, you know. And I know I've seen people change a lot during the course of their learning that they don't need to have a plan necessarily, that they don't need that. They can walk into a room and look around and then kind of do. And it's quite a change to see people who are freed from self-imposed regulation participation in that David's process.
Did he get reactions from the actors as well that were maybe rather positive than, you know, I mean, you could imagine that they, if they are used to normal kinds of directions, you know, when you have a proper script and then you're being said what to do, basically, and then if they came into a situation like that, that they would kind of feel insecure, yeah, or something like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, everybody falls under the spell of the 900-pound gorilla. If you're an actor, though, you know, you go, well, you know, some other actors have done pretty well listening to this guy. Even if your initial instinct is, no, I had it right the first time. It's my idea, I understand. You know, this guy's trying to tell me how to act, you know. But if you stay open and you keep a degree of humility, you know, they do very well. And most people either have a degree of humility in acting or they can have it imposed on them, which is, that was an interesting procedure. But David's very good at that. And those resistances, when you're an actor, the night before, if you're lucky enough to get your script that far in advance, you'll do some preparation and you'll have an idea, which may not be the right idea, about the content of the scene and the scene's overall purpose and your purpose within the scene, which might include, you know, some behaviors. And if you're insecure or you don't have enough time to prepare, you might get fixated on a prop. And a prop is a very dangerous thing because it then is the actor's way of taking the attention from other actors and from the behavior that's necessary to make the scene work. And that has to be, you know, pulled out quickly and as painlessly and as in as short a time as it can be done. And it is, you know, I mean, you have to do that, and he does.
Of course, just pretending not to know more and just to let out a little bit of what I know, because I ordered the American edition of Deadwood more recently.
Oh, you've seen David on that?
I've seen all the extras, which are also promised on the European version, but they are not on the DVD, which is outrageous, of course. You know, I've managed now to finally see some of the actors, like the one who's playing Alma Garrett, saying this was the experience of a lifetime, to have worked on this show. And you don't have the feeling that this is the you know, the usual kind of praising last project as the best and so forth.
That's true. I mean, it was a hideous love fest, especially at the end there. And the one thing that would drive me crazy is that because David is, as Tom described him, he's a fascinating person. People would talk, they'd spend every, you know, if you see four people talking, I know what they're talking about. You know, it would be Dave. And the discussion of his movements, his habits, his personal quirks, you know, how long he was in, you know, it's just, I've never seen anything like it. I got so thoroughly sick of it when Christoph said, you know, I want to talk about David a little bit. You know, I don't know. But the truth is, you know, he's a very interesting character. Yeah. Well, I've had three teachers, and he is the last of them, I hope.
You know, things like a heroin habit and so forth. They're sometimes, I guess, usual for a certain type of. They're good, you know, for the fame of certain types of artists, like writers, you know, like literature. In film, you would rather think, you know, with so much money involved, this is a liability, and from all. You and everybody says here about him, all these things don't work against him, but rather, you know.
Well, you know, you can get somebody who is reliable and stable and well-educated, but you can't always get what David has with that particular package, and that's... You know, a risk. I mean, if I was in charge of a network, I mean, I would have to take the talent where I found it. You know, and artists have historically not always been the best balanced folks in the world. As long as they're striving for that balance and they're not elevating aspects or character defects to a central place. To draw attention to themselves, make they're as functional as anybody else, and you know David's addiction in the past has not been one of those things that there have been a number of people in Hollywood who have, you know, they've taken their habits, you know, and made them a sort of a central part of their marketing scheme. That was not the case with Dave, and he spent you know a long time trying to overcome that and has, and it remains a battle, but it's an essential part of his personality. It's not an affectation of any kind. It's just his little cross to bear, and
So in this whole time you worked on, for instance, on Deadwood, you never had the experience of, like, let's say, an HBO executive, coming to the scene there where you were filming and, like, you know, sweating and whatever, you know, trying to, you know, find out about, get
the next day's work.
Yeah, you know,
so yeah, everybody wants to know
hear about
that.
Some plans or.
Yep. Then, it would more be other people who said, do we have something for Thursday from the production department? But there's always something. It's just like, when? Are we going to have it in time for the Xerox, or do we need to pay people overtime to get the script out? But HBO, if they did their sweating, they did it in their offices. They, may have chewed their fingers off. I don't think so. I think, as Tom said, Chris Albrecht was in charge, and... there wasn't a tremendous amount of fear there as there was in other places, and because they weren't handicapped by their own fear, they were able to, you know, make some pretty good television. So when they came, they just came to visit. When Chris Albrecht left, they began to see a little bit more fear there, and you can see its effect on their programming, and Tom Fontana said that has maybe started to turn around. I hope so. because that was one of the few places left that wasn't driven either by preconceptions of what an audience wants in their programming, meaning, well, let's have doctors break out of prison. Because we know doctors work and we know prison works, and we can put some, you know, so that, you know, you would just, it's like, you know, taking ingredients and combining them in a way that is not, there's nothing inherently wrong with eating, you know, pickles and ice cream, but it's kind of a shock value alone. That's all that there is there. There isn't much in sugar and salt. There's just not that much there. And there's a kind of a zombie television that I talked to Christoph about, and I'll just bore you with shortly, that after the Second World War in the South Pacific Islands, so there were native peoples who became so used, while the Americans were based there, to the fruits of the occupation, the supplies and Coca-Cola and you know, all those things, that when the Americans went, everything was taken away. The cornucopia was shut off, and they missed it. They wanted it, and they developed a cult, a religious. They called it a cargo cult, and they would build these airplanes, and they looked great. They looked just like the ones that really flew, you know. And they would get in them, and they had the equipment that they would make out of, and the guys would make engine noises, and they're hoping that, you know, the planes would come back, and that they would bring the good things that had gone, and. That's what goes on in television. Sometimes it happens, and it's very eerie when it does. You have these empty vessels, and everybody's walking around as if it was a real plane, and it's not, and it's never going to fly. And if you know anything at all about, you know, aerodynamics or drama, you just go, you know, there's no content in that thing. It has no engine, and that's not a real pilot, by the way. They don't know that either. And the more scared people get, the more likely they are to believe that. And that's what you see a lot of these days in many places. And if there's no functioning intelligence or heart and all those things, that the spirit at the heart of an organization, then it's, you know, you can go in there with any kind of an idea, and if it's real, it kind of creeps them out. It's sort of like you're on the other side. The way that I'm estranged and feel a little frightened by people who are imagining the model aircraft is going to actually take off, they feel the same way about me. When I go in there and I talk to them about something I believe is real, they start to fidget a bit, and I can see them sweating, and I'm going, oh, this guy's fucking crazy, you know. And I don't do well with them, you know. So I hope they're not universal. They never have been. I'm always able to find an open door somewhere.
Why do you think Deadwood got aborted after only three seasons, and against the heavy protest of a large community of viewers, and with this whole investment that was, you know, put into reconstructing the set and so forth?
Well, I guess the simplest explanation. I mean, there are a lot of personal stuff at play, like, you know. The confluence of a river and the sea. But the simplest thing is that Paramount Pictures owned David when he made the deal with HBO. So their part for letting him go to work for HBO, they had all the foreign rights. So HBO paid the entire cost of the production, and they weren't able to take any of the foreign revenues for themselves. So for 4 years. And so they were kind of going in the hole, and a cable network has no advertising, so there's no real measurement other than critical of the success. And, you know, Deadwood got lots of nominations for Emmys, and I went, and they couldn't even show a clip at the show, the awards show. I mean, they're just too many cocksuckers. So it didn't win any Emmys, and so that happened, and then Chris Albrecht had some personal problems, which resulted in him leaving the network, and then there was just sort of not static in the air, and for a bit, and in that period is when they didn't go on with it. And you know, if Chris had remained it certainly would have, you know, we would have concluded the story. And I had in mind, most of the stuff is true, by the way, in that show. There was a judge, this is how I wanted to end the show. There was a judge named Granville Bennett who would have introduced, and one of the histories of the town of Deadwood, the mining town, was written by his daughter, Esteline. And when about 10 years after our period here, the railroad finally reached Deadwood, Granville Bennett was down with the others watching the train come in. And when it came, the passengers were coming off, he said, "Now we're gonna have to lock our doors."
I can imagine that there are a couple of questions out there as well, so please join the conversation.
You've promised us yesterday in your introductory talk that you were going to talk with that man about the question of how much the TV production Deadwood was related to the novel.
Thank you. Yeah. Do you know all about the Pete Dexter's
novel? David said he never read it. I've read it. I believe David. I mean, I don't think he had read it and didn't know about it. Maybe somebody at HBO read it and said, you know, that'd be a great series idea. But what Pete Dexter thinks, I don't know either. So I don't know him. But I saw something like that happen once before. Stephen Bosco did a show called Cop Rock, and there was a great British musical, The Singing Detective. Dennis Potter did it, and Dennis Potter was convinced that Bosco had ripped him off and done this Cop Rock musical. And whether he did or not, I have no idea. But they did have quite a spat on the television show then. I couldn't give the victory to either one, but they both looked a little pathetic. Yeah. So I don't know. It's, you know, the story of Deadwood is a great tale in Dexter's book, and in the history itself is there are so many things in there that didn't get done that I do wish we had been able to go on.
I mean, to tell you the truth, I have some doubts that David Milch has never heard of this book or...
Oh, I certainly heard of the book, but,
he didn't inhale.
No, I doubt he did. You know, just knowing his reading habits, he tends to avoid contemporary fiction and as if it were, Anthrax. So, he would be more likely to read Walter Benjamin than Pete Dexter. No insult to Pete, but I mean, I thought the book was great. It's, you get to a certain place in your art, you don't need other artists anymore, you know? I mean, you can go and you can look at their work, but you don't need it to teach you anything about technique or what the, you know, how to do a character. And mere event doesn't help you. Mere event that somebody does in a work of fiction is, you know, it's neither here nor there. It's, you know, and tone is something that, you know, David's tone is the same in NYPD Blue as it is in Deadwood, and it is in Hill Street. The language changes, the characters and situations are a little different, but the same, you know, ghost behind the characters is still there. That same spirit, you know, that is, you know, tough and compassionate as well. So I would rip off Pete Dexter in a minute.
Well, I mean, you know, it wouldn't be necessary to rip him off or so or anything, but just, you know, to...
Here's a good subject.
Yeah, yeah, to find a subject. And also, you know, the way this kind of realism that was mm-hmm. also, I think, was really new in the book as well. Yeah. And that kind of...
Well, maybe Pete Dexter ripped off Michael Odachi. You know, you ever read his Billy the Kid?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And this was, I had read Billy the Kid a couple of years before Deadwood, and I thought that had, you know, might have some relation. Yeah. Please.
You're mentioning that David Mitchell, your third teacher.
Who yes.
The first and the second one, and what did you learn from them, and especially what did you learn from David Mitchell?
Well, my first was Doug Kenny, who was a comedy writer at the magazine I worked at. And he hired me, and he wrote a movie called Animal House, which I'm sure everybody saw. And some people I've met seem to think that it was a comedy movie like Porky's. And it wasn't. It's just that's a cargo cult impression. So he was my first teacher, and we did a lot of interest. He taught me, for one thing, there was nothing really that you couldn't write about if you thought about it. And there's nothing really you shouldn't write about. In fact, you should write about certain things that people tended to avoid because of the shameful nature of them, or, you know, for other reasons. He was one. The second one was... a guy who his only work that anybody might have seen if they go to the musical theater was my one and only. He was a theatrical writer who had been the poet Robert Lowell's student at Harvard, and he taught me a lot about formal things about rhyme and that sort of thing. And he was a hunchback. Tim Mayer was his name, and when I met Tim in Martha's Vineyard, we spent a few days together driving around, staying up all night in this convertible. And a day or two later, I met this girl in a store, and she said to me, "Who is that hunchback I saw you riding around with the other day?" I said, "I don't know," because I had never noticed. I didn't notice. It was the last thing you would notice about him. He was also a very... you know, and then David, he was a character like David. He was, unforgettable. And then David taught me not to murder myself. He taught me certain techniques to avoid killing yourself through excess or through dissatisfaction with the nature of the world. And David was Robert Penn Warren's student at Yale. And Penn Warren had taught him the same thing. And it's distilled very well, if you want to read the short form, in Penn Warren's homage to Theodore Dreiser, which is an essay, but it's opened with a poem which says it all. And in the third section of that poem called Morals, because Penn Warren was very puzzled by Theodore Dreiser. Dreiser was, it's not to everybody's taste as a novelist, but no one would deny his comprehensive covering of the human scheme and his lucidity and his tremendous vision but he was also a, I don't know what you say, a sexual pervert. He would masturbate 13 times a day in a chair. He had a taste for mother and daughter relationships concurrent. He puzzled Penn Warren so deeply that Penn Warren didn't stop thinking about him until he understood him. And when he did, you know, he wrote the essay for, you know, formal academic reasons, and the poem for, because that was the graceful way to sum it up. And that, that's what David taught me.
When you started acting as well, how did that affect your writing?
How did the acting?
When you started acting as well, how did that?
No sound.
How did that affect your writing?
It well, I always wrote the scenes that I was in, you know. So I was careful not to, you know. It's kind of distracting if you're writing for like six people and you're in it, and you know, you may have this self scrutiny that, you know. Well, you don't want to make it all about you, for instance, you know, which is an instinct. But then you have to be careful, because if you're trying not to make it all about you, you might short yourself. So I found it a little distracting, but where I would fuck up, you know, the presiding hand of David would correct things. But I love acting, and often thought that had I discovered that earlier, I would never have ever typed anything in my life. I would like to be. They carry, you know, if you're an actor, it's kind of a handicap, really, because they'll treat you like a child. You know, you're in your trailer, they send somebody to your door, oh, it's time to go now. You know, you never have to think if you don't want to. You can live a kind of vegetative existence where you only exist when the camera is on in somebody else's emotions. But ultimately, it's kind of crippling, you know, and the good actors aren't crippled by it, obviously, but there are many who are deceived by this attention, and they just become like infants, and they throw telephones and bounce them off people's heads and stuff. You know, it's I probably would have been that type.
Could you hand
the microphone? Hi, it's just a quick question, really. There was a lot of rumours going around that there would be a film to tie up all the storylines that weren't finished in Deadwood. Is there ever going to happen?
I don't think so at this point. I mean, I certainly was one of the believers in those rumours. HBO paid some money to have some films written, and for one reason or another, that money went astray. But that's not why the films were made. It's just they decided not to. The time elapsed, and the set and the props and all those, everything was sitting out in Santa Clarita for a couple of years. Very expensive to keep it there, and eventually it just kind of dispersed. And now, to put it all back together, not to mention putting the people back together, would be prohibitively expensive and so forth. So I don't think now it'll ever happen. No. But they say, you know, you should leave the audience hungry.
Yes, please. This is a gentleman.
Hinten rechts, zweites Drittel.
Can you tell us a little bit about your writing routines? Do you have any routines in writing? Do you have to?
Well, I find that the steering wheel of a car is good for banging your forehead on if you're having trouble thinking. I actually lately have come to a change in the way I work. I used to just sit down and type, you know, like anybody else. And I took this job, which I thought I would be able to do in a month, to write a mini series about the Hatfields and McCoys, because those are two feuding families in America after the Civil War. Everybody knows the names, but nobody knows the story, really. And there was a pre-existing script, and I thought, well, I'll just, you know, type it over and turn it in. But to make the month, I said, you know, I'll dictate it. Get me a guy to type it up. But when I started just by composing the scenes into this tape recorder as I walked in the hills, and giving them to the guy, and he'd type them up, and then I'd rewrite them, and then they go in. I found that I wasn't rewriting the script at all, that I had forgotten about it, and it ended up taking eight months instead of one. So I lost a fortune, and I was as happy as I'd ever been because it was going so well. So I'll probably write like that forever, you know, now, because it turned out so well.
There was another thank you for the image of the cargo cult. It seems to the idea of like a simulation that is animated and functions and moves along. Yeah. It seems like it could be extended more broadly into maybe American society in general. But one of the things about the subject matter of all of the shows, or a lot of the shows that we're talking about, is that they're very, very dark. And I wonder if definitely in the case of The Wire and Deadwood and The Sopranos, there's a sense that there's an element of social critique.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing. I mean, they're dark because I think that life has, we tend not to, you know, that's the original reason for drama. We don't want to look directly at it, you know, because it's very disheartening, it's sad. So we look at it on the stage, and we can talk about it that way. And the things you can talk about on the stage that, you know, you can't really, you know, talk about over coffee. They're frightening. They're disturbing. They're, you know, but I'm trying to think. Well, you know, I probably had a stroke. That's what happened. I can't think now. Say the question again.
No, I didn't get. I was going to ask if you think that this element of social critique.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Do you think that functioned it functions in America?
It does. It does. It does. But the interesting thing was that. The Guardian newspaper is a representative sample of the progressive left / Marxist side of life. Thought Deadwood was an extended treatise on you know, proletarian virtues and values. On the right, the extreme right in America, they loved Deadwood because it was all about self-reliance and independence. So these two polar opposites were both convinced that, you know, David was essentially writing for them. And I found it very amusing, and I still do. And that's what will happen if your work of art is successful, and that's how you know it has an engine. And if you find that only the left side of your audience is responding positively, you've got to make an adjustment, because you don't want to confirm people in what they already are convinced of. You want to be able to show them that the picture is a little bit bigger and more complex. And there was an American Secretary of State for whom I hold no special affection, but he said, you have to make things clearer than the truth with regard to policy, because the truth is too Rococo and it's too Byzantine and it's too complicated and it can't be summed up and it's this and it's that. And I don't know if that's the case. I mean, certainly pragmatically it's the case, I guess, in politics, but it's not the case in art. I mean, you can simplify without being doing a disservice to either side of the political debate. You know what I mean? I don't.
Anybody else?
Well, if not, I would have maybe a final question about this very, very strange series. I think I really like strangeness, but I've found this series to be also a little too strange for me. I'm talking about John from Cincinnati. Does anybody in this room know this series?
I mentioned this one.
Yeah. Well, David, that you know this series, I would have suspected. But are you the only one here? Somebody else. Okay, but not very.
Well, it was sometimes the magic works, sometimes it doesn't. It was very ambitious. It was a series about surfers and the divine, and. The entrance of the of God into life as represented by a human being. So that's not always easy to do. And I think this is my guess as to why you can't do it, is because essentially you can do the dance of the seven veils, but if when the last veil comes off, you have the invisible man or woman behind, everybody's disappointed. And if you're doing that, you can do that with the divine and then pull it off and then there's nothing there and everybody goes, oh, thanks a lot, you know. I was hoping for the answer to these questions and by their very nature, there is no answer that I'm aware of, but I'm not divine myself, you know. And that's kind of what happened, and that, you know, and David is not at home with surfers. He himself doesn't surf, you know.
He reads which is not necessarily anything speaking answer, as we know in the case of the Beach Boys and Brian Wilson, who wrote a lot of good songs about surfing, but hated the sea. But anyway,
did he hate surfers? Did he hate surfers?
Well, he didn't hate surfers, but he hated the sea. And he would never go to the sea.
I think David was profoundly alienated by the culture of surfing. And if you ask a surfer why do you like surfing, quite often the answer is, you know, if you're just out there on the waves, man, you just like feel so much a part of everything, you know. Is that it? Yeah, man, don't you know that? I try, you know, to feel a part. So that for David, that was very difficult, you know, and but he'll love, you know, sociopathic behaviors of all sorts. So he'll be able to pick that part of the surfing culture out and dwell on it, you know, and he did. So there were parts of it, you know, that were very funny and were great, yeah. And then there were parts that were just empty. Empty virtuosity is the phrase that springs to mind.
Yeah, I think John from Cincinnati, without the character of John from Cincinnati, would have been much better.
Yes, but that's just, I agree.
Nobody understands what we're talking about. Anyway, so maybe we end on this
sure
note. Thank you so much for coming.